It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You never can tell how and when a cook's imagination will take off. For instance, that moment when Indian chef Raghavan Iyer was sipping a cocktail.
One of the days when I was having a good mojito, I thought, wow, this would be amazing as a dressing for a good waxy potato. And so I took some fresh mint and key limes, and I muddled the two together. So the essential oils from the skin of the lime sort of permeated and flavored the mint, and threw in some coarse cracked black peppercorns and a really good sea salt. And to give it a further pizzazz, I actually swirled in some fresh pomegranate seeds.
Take that, potato salad. There's lots more coming your way this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Raghavan Iyer is an Indian chef and writer who's tallied up awards for his classes and his writings, like his inspired tome, 660 Curries. The man has this gift with seasonings. Now in his latest book, he's coming to terms with a lifelong addiction, potatoes. He has new recipes from nearly every continent, and the book is called Smashed, Mashed, Boiled, and Baked, and Fried, too. Raghavan, good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure as always.
Am I right that potatoes for the first time have names?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just russet and red skin. It's designer potatoes, right?
It is. And I think, you know, finally they're coming into the limelight after, what, 10,000 years?
Something
like that.
Yeah.
But you're right. Potatoes do have varietal names. But I think for the most part, you know, people still shop based on the kind of potato they want for their recipe. Especially in North America, you see people are still looking for, you know, either your russets or your Yukon gold, but nobody's going to go into the store and say, do you have any Kennebec? We shoppers are still very much just looking for the type of potato.
Okay, so the book divides up potatoes by essentially their style.
Yes.
They're starchy, they're waxy, they're new, in quotation marks. And that dictates a lot about, you know, what recipe you're going to use them in. But just to get people thinking about looking for names, a couple in each category that we should keep an eye out for?
I feel like the workhorse of, you know, the starchy potato is the russet Burbank. That's your common potato that is now available just about everywhere.
And that's a great baker.
It's a great baking potato, but it's also a great potato for making the ultimate mashed potatoes as well, because of its low moisture content and high starch content. The Yukon Gold, which is a Canadian variety named after the Yukon River, but they added the name Gold to sort of pay homage to the California Gold Rush.
Oh.
And it's sort of middle of the line in terms of starch and moisture. So it's supposed to be like an all-purpose potato, whether you're making mashed potatoes or whether you're making potato salads. But on the other end of the spectrum, you know, you've got your red potatoes or your fingerlings now, which have a high moisture content.
Those are waxy,
and they are beautiful for – so if you want the potato to hold itself well, to be cohesive, especially for pan roasting and for boiling, those work really well. And you're starting to see, you know, names like the Peruvian purple potato and the Russian banana and the Amarosa.
So what would you do with these? For instance, the Kennebec or the waxy kind of potatoes?
The waxy kind of potatoes, I would, you know, there's an amazing sort of my go-to salad. And I don't know about you, but, you know, I have a craving for a good mojito sometimes. And so one of the days when I was having a good mojito, I thought, wow, this would be amazing as a dressing for a good waxy potato. And so I had a variety of fingerlings, multicolored, that I boiled it until just they were tender. You don't want to overcook them. Then I took, in a mortar, I took some fresh mint and key limes. I had some key limes.
Uh-huh.
And I muddled the two together. So the essential oils from the skin of the lime sort of permeated and flavored the mint. And the mint got much stronger, and threw in some coarse cracked black peppercorns and a really good sea salt. And then to top it all, I just added a little bit of sugar for balance, but I poured some white rum into it.
You actually did the alcohol part.
I did, because that's what made it a mojito. And so I combined all of that. Then I added it to the fingerling potatoes. As you know, Lynn, that the best way to for the potatoes to absorb the flavor is you can toss them while they're still warm.
Yeah, yeah.
And oftentimes people forget to do that. And so to give it a further pizzazz, I actually swirled in some fresh pomegranate seeds. And what
I looked, gorgeous to look at.
Gorgeous. And the word that came to my mind was sexy, you know.
That too. Yeah.
Because I think we eat with all our senses. And to see the flavors come alive and the mojito just sort of, you know, sang with such pizzazz, and the mint came through beautifully well.
And lime, which is wonderful.
Yeah. And
with
the key
potatoes.
Limes really made a big difference.
Now, that reminds me, you have a couple of recipes from the potatoes homeland, Peruvian recipes.
Yes, I have an amazing soup, locro de papa. The Ecuadorians also claim that to be their soup as well.
Uh-huh.
And so, but it's potatoes that are actually boiled in milk. And I to make it much richer, I added some cream cheese to that. And I punctuated the potato with a combination of cumin and anado seed, which I ground, or the achiote seed, which gives that beautiful sort of a sunny disposition, a little bit of cayenne for a kick, and I pureed everything. And the color of that soup was so dynamite. And you top it off with scallions and fresh avocado with a little bit of queso fresco or blanco, and you feel like this is the perfect soup for cold weather.
Oh, this sounds delicious.
But of course, you know, I'm a fried freak. And so to me, one of my favorite recipes in the book is cheesy tater tots with fresh tarragon.
Cheesy tater tots. So what do you do? Is it mashed potatoes?
No, it's actually I used Yukon Gold for that. Or you could use russet as well. And you sort of fry them at a low temperature and then until it's just barely brown. And then you drain it. And once it's cool, I pulse that with cheese curds. Because of the low moisture and just a little potato starch to bring it all together. And then I throw in some fresh tarragon. And then you shape them into these little tater tots. And then you fry them second time at a higher temperature. And oh, my God. The recipe says you could feed about four people. But for me, it was just one person.
And it's very similar the way you make French fries.
It is.
A low temperature fry and then high temperature.
And then high temperature fry.
Okay, I'm sold. Raghavan, thank you.
It's my pleasure, Lynn, as always. It's great to be with you.
Raghavan Iyer's book is smashed, mashed, boiled, and baked, and fried, too. He left us with a recipe for Peruvian potato soup, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org. There's some new action in the tofu aisle. Elbowing in front of the tofu and the other meat stand-ins is jackfruit. Until now, jackfruit lived usually in Asian markets. Now it's hit mainstream. Jackfruit is hyped as the new wonder food for non-meat eaters. You can buy it drenched in barbecue sauce or teriyaki or curried. So, what gives? To separate fact from fiction, our managing producer, Sally Swift, talked to The Washington Post food and dining editor, Joe Yonan.
Hey, Joe Yonan, nice to have you in the studio.
Oh, thanks, Allie. It's fun to do it this way.
I have a question for you. You've done this big piece on jackfruit, both you and Bonnie Benwick, your deputy editor at The Washington Post. So why are we seeing so much jackfruit?
Well, there's a couple things going on. There's been a long time availability in a lot of Asian markets of the fresh jackfruit.
They're bigger than your heads.
Right.
And they have, they're all pokey all over the place.
Right, right.
Quite daunting.
Yes, absolutely. They look a little bit like a porcupine,
exactly.
Green porcupine, the size of maybe two or three of your heads.
Right.
And sometimes you see them hacked open or sold in big pieces, which is because it's really daunting. They're huge and they're actually a little bit difficult to work with. The flesh is really sticky, and it coats your cutting board, it coats your knife.
And what does it taste like when it's ripe?
Well, it's a beautiful taste. It's a little mango-y, a little banana-y, a little pineapple-y. It's got sort of all those tropical flavors. You know, there's been some theory that the gum juicy fruit was based on the flavor of jackfruit, which Wrigley's, I think they make juicy fruit, right? Mm-hmm. They have never disclosed that, but people have theorized that. So it's got a little bit of that, like, sweet, but a little kind of mysterious flavor too.
Now, it's also being touted as a meat substitute.
Right, right. And there's been some misinformation about this out there. So it's two different things, sort of like mangoes that are green versus mangoes that are ripe. You know, a green mango is used in a lot of slaws and stuff in Southeast Asia. In the same way, a green jackfruit has a very different texture. It's much firmer. And you can kind of pull it the same way you pull pork. It's got these little strands, and it's got kind of a chewier texture. So in some parts of the world, people have used it as a meat substitute, and it's been packaged as such by some companies here in the United States called, one of them is called Upton's Naturals. There's another one that's called, I think, just the Jackfruit Company, and they are seasoning it and packaging it as a shelf-stable way for you to get like a quick, you can put it in sandwiches or you can stir fry it or eat it in kind of a lot of the same ways that you might have shredded meat.
But the crazy thing about jackfruit, from what I understand, is that it's very low in protein, correct?
Right, right.
So what, why would we do that?
Right, it is somewhat of a head scratcher to me in a way, because I do think that, you know, if I want something that just reminds me of the texture of meat, you know, I have a lot of options. You know, I can eat the portobello mushroom, for goodness sake, or a beet, those kinds of things. So I'm personally a little mystified about why you need to source something from, you know, halfway across the world in order to have a meat substitute. But having said that, I can't fault people for looking for different options, and it's pretty tasty. So,
well, you worked up some recipes, or you worked up a recipe, correct?
Yes.
So what did you do to make it work for you?
Well, for one thing, I prefer to work with jackfruit that's not seasoned and flavored, because then it gives you a lot of options. You can take it in a lot of different directions. Now, it's not that easy to find that way. So, but in big Asian supermarkets, you can find it canned. And you want to look for the jackfruit that's canned in water or brine and not in syrup. And you slice it and you pan fry it. This is what I did. And I added I found a recipe online that suggested some of these things, and I simplified it. But I tossed it with some jerk type seasonings and then combined it in a wrap / burrito with some black beans to help that protein and some mango. And it was delicious.
Huh. I'm a little stumped, as that you were too, it sounds like.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, we had the big fresh jackfruit in the office, and I watched Bonnie Benwick, you know, hack into it. And she wrote a really fun piece about, you know, how people should handle jackfruit. But I do think there's been a lot of confusion between the two types. You know, people have read about jackfruit as a meat substitute and as a great possibility for vegetarians and vegans. And then they see the giant fruit in their Whole Foods and they think, oh, I can hack that up and put it in tacos. And that really is not something that I would advise, because, you know, that would be like eating a banana taco.
Got it. That seems clear. Thank you, Joe.
Sure. My pleasure.
Joe Yonan is author of Eat Your Vegetables, Bold Recipes for the Single Cook. And he left us with that recipe for jackfruit, black bean, and mango burritos from the Washington Post. And you can find it at splendidtable.org. Coming up, Bridget Lancaster of America's Test Kitchen and her quest for a sourdough starter and butter in religious ceremonies. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from 8 p.m. American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Sometimes I think that people who are not food pros think that those people who are food pros have everything all figured out. Au contraire. I remember a phone call I had with the late, great Julia Child. She was close to 90 when I asked her what she was working on, and she said, duck. The work and the curiosity never stops. Just ask America's Test Kitchen's Bridget Lancaster.
So I'm Bridget Lancaster. I work for America's Test Kitchen, and we're here in my kitchen in Marblehead, just north of Boston. Today we're working on a little bit of sourdough, and George, my assistant, is always here to help me. Aren't you, George? So George is currently my favorite child. He is an 150-some-pound Newfoundland. George is a great crumb catcher. George would love the sourdough. Bread is one of George's favorite foods, isn't it, George? Yeah. So many people are really intimidated by sourdough, but it's basically, if you've ever had a goldfish and you've kept it alive for more than a couple of months, you can make sourdough. You need flour and you need water. And that's it. There's something great about starting a recipe with so little. And in the flour, there's wild yeast already in there. And there's bacteria in there as well. And the yeast and the bacteria get to work. It's like a little Pac-Man. They're starting to feed off of the natural sugars. And they start to procreate and they multiply, creating thousands and thousands of microorganisms. This is George telling me to be quiet. George, come here. Here, buddy. You want a cookie? He loves these little cookies, these little dog biscuits. So it's always good to use a glass container when you're starting sourdough. That way you can see what's going on underneath the surface. So the flour we're using is a mix, almost equal parts of whole wheat flour and all-purpose flour. It's a good idea to use organic flour for this because it's been processed less. So it's so easy to make. You have a cup of the flour mix and room temp water. For the water, you want to use distilled water, filtered water. You don't want to use tap water. Tap water has chlorine in it, and the chlorine has been shown to kill the yeast. Let me go get a wooden spoon. You can also use a rubber spatula for this. So I'm just mixing this together, and what you want to look for is the mixture to have no more streaks of dry flour. All right. I'm just going to put a piece of plastic wrap on it. We're going to leave it out here at room temperature. More fermentation happens at warmer temperatures, so putting this in the fridge is not a good idea at this point. Within 48 to 72 hours, it's going to start to bubble. And so that brings us to how we maintain our starter. Now we have to feed it. I would say this is the most high-maintenance part of sourdough, but it's only about 2 weeks. So I've got another bowl here, and this is a starter that I made about 48 hours ago. I would let it go a little bit more, but you can see it's definitely a different texture from what we had before. The amount has pretty much doubled in size. It's puffy. There's a little bit of bubbling action on there, which is great. We know that the yeast is alive. The bacteria is feeding. I'm going to uncover it, and we can give it a quick smell here. Dirty socks comes to mind. This is where a lot of people go, oh, it's gone off. It's bad. I got to get rid of it. No, actually, that means it's alive. This is actually a great sign. This means that the yeast is feeding, the bacteria is multiplying. That's what you're smelling, all that lactic acid the bacteria is forming. It's funky, and not like in a good way funky. This is like stinky funky, and you got to get through the stink to get to the really good part. So I'm going to grab another clean bowl. So you take a quarter cup of your starter. It's almost like chewing gum or taffy at this point. And we can get rid of the rest of the starter that's in here. So that was a quarter cup of the starter and a quarter cup of water. And we're also adding a little bit more of our flour mix, about a half a cup. And we'll go ahead and stir this together. And that is your daily chore for about 10, maybe up to 14 days. Of course, you cover it with plastic wrap again. And during this time, it's going to go from a stinky, smelly mess to something that has a beautiful, tangy aroma. Think buttermilk, think yogurt. And that's when you know that your starter is ready to use. And once we're at the point where our starter has matured, we really just want it to stay alive. And this is where it gets really easy because instead of feeding it once a day, we're going to only feed it once a week. And to do that, we scoop out about a quarter cup of our starter mixture. And this time we're not using our flour blend. We're just using all-purpose flour. So half a cup of that, a quarter cup more of our distilled water. Mix it. So now this is going to sit at room temp for 5 hours. Then we're going to move it into the fridge, and it can stay in there for up to a week before you have to do this again. And the best part of sourdough is after you take a little bit of that starter and you incorporate it into a bread recipe, you can really taste the adventure that you've gone through. It's soured, it's matured, it has all these different notes in the bread itself. Even the best bakery out there with the best sourdough bread, there's something about pulling that bread out of your own oven, cutting into that amazing crust and serving it without butter, without oil, without anything. You have a flavor profile that's unlike anything else. And if you have any scraps of sourdough around, be sure that you have a giant dog like my George, who's happy to clean up your mess after. Isn't that right? It's like having farm animals in your house.
Bridget Lancaster is host of America's Test Kitchen television show. You can find a recipe for their foolproof, almost no-need sourdough bread on the website, splendidtable.org. You'd think a book about butter would be filled with recipes. But that is exactly what Elaine Kushrova's book, Butter, A Rich History, is not filled with. Instead, it's brimming with ritual, history, politics, and science. And yeah, truthfully, there's a couple of recipes. Elaine writes about food and is the former editor of Culture, a magazine all about cheese. She's traveled the world researching this butter book, and our contributor, Melissa Clark, gets the report.
Elaine, hello. I'm so glad to be talking to you today.
My pleasure to be here.
So one of the surprises for me in reading your book was to learn all about the connection between butter and religion. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that subject was really interesting for me too, and surprising. I wasn't expecting to find that ancient cultures around the world used butter as a sacred tool for their spiritual practices. This is going back to the Sumerians, 2500 BC, and the Vedic Aryans, the Druids, the Hindus, the Buddhists. All of these cultures use butter in their worship practices. Most of these rituals are gone, but the Tibetan Buddhists still do these elaborate butter carvings called tormas that are central to their spiritual practice.
What do you think gives butter that kind of aura that makes it seem religious or spiritual in a way?
Well, for most of butter's history, in fact, the process of making butter was mysterious. It was an enigma. You know, how is it that you can take milk and through a process of simply rocking or beating it, you know, this invisible fat that's in the milk suddenly blooms into beautiful pieces of butter? So, you know, until the late 1800s, butter was little understood but highly valued. And so it was deemed much like pearls and oysters or rainbows, you know, some of these wonderful mysteries in the world. So that was really, I think, at the root of why butter became so useful in a sacred way, for what it symbolized, essentially.
Which was magic.
Magic, exactly.
So historically, women have always played a very big role in butter making. Would you talk a little bit about women's roles in butter making?
Well, first of all, you know, it's not overstating it to say that women really founded the butter industry, because it was taboo for men to have anything to do with the dairy arts for most of the history of humankind and, you know, since we've been milking animals. I found this across the world, this taboo against men milking, making butter, doing cheese making, and that survived up until the 1800s. You know, milk is about birth and lactation and fertility. You know, it's very much a sort of feminine domain. And because they had a monopoly on butter making, you know, they gained a certain status from it because butter, of course, was valuable.
And you got to see some of this firsthand. I know you traveled to India and you got to see some traditional butter making.
I did. I went specifically to see the butter that's made from water buffalo milk. That would be the traditional milk in India, and that was for centuries. That was the animal that was most suited to the climate in India. And so water buffalo butter is their traditional butter. It's now disappearing. Cow butter has become much more prevalent. But the water buffalo butter is a cultured product that I was particularly interested in seeing how they make it. And so I was able to go to this small village in the north of India in Punjab and meet with these two elderly women. And they showed me how they take the water buffalo milk and they culture it overnight and they make this super delicious, rich yogurt called dahi. And that dahi is then put into a churn. You know, a generation ago, it would have been a beautiful metal churn. This particular day that I was visiting, they just put it into a plastic bucket. But they still use their unique system of churning, which involves a pole, a center pole, that has a cross piece on the bottom that goes into the milk, and then they alternately pull on the ends of a rope. So imagine this center pole is being spun around by the women pulling on the ropes either side, you know, back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And that system of churning doesn't exist anywhere else in the world. So I really wanted to document that because, in fact, it is disappearing. Even in this particular remote village, the women told me that they use a blender now to make their butter. So I was glad I was able to document it and see it. I think in a generation, it probably won't exist anymore.
Now, you mentioned that it was cultured butter, and I know that I can buy cultured butter in the supermarket. I can also buy, I can buy a lot of different butters. I can buy high-fat European butter. I can buy sheep butter and goat butter in the health food store. Can you just walk us through the differences?
We'll start with the simplest first. That would be sweet cream butter. That is butter that's simply cream put into a churn until butter happens. And if it's an industrial churn, it happens in 3 seconds. But it's essentially just cream made into butter. If you have cultured butter, that means that the cream has been mixed with a lactic bacteria, sort of a cocktail of lactic bacteria, and allowed to ferment at least 12 hours, usually longer. And the point of that is to develop complexity of flavor in the cream. You know, butter has 120 different flavor compounds. And by culturing it, you can intensify some of the really good ones like diacetyl. That's the compound that gives us that quintessential butter flavor. And culturing also is synonymous with a little bit of acidity. So if you can balance like the sweet and the acid and the butteriness, that's a world-class butter. And then the European style that's, you know, in quotes, that's what the many labels say. That essentially means a high-fat butter, a higher fat, because the standard in the States is for 80% fat in a stick of butter. The European-style higher-fat butters can have 82, 84, 86% fat, which may not sound like a lot of difference, but when you're a baker, it makes a whole lot of difference.
So you would say bake with the European butter, and then if you were going to just spread some butter on bread and eat it, you would use the cultured butter for the extra flavor.
That's what I prefer. As far as baking, the higher fat butter is particularly good for pastry. If I'm making a cake, I don't actually feel like the extra butter fat makes much of a difference. The only exception would be a pound cake where I want that super rich density.
That makes sense. Now, talk to us about how butter gains its different flavors. You had written in the book that the flavor of butter comes from three different things, from the animal's diet, from the type and species of animal, and also from human artistry.
Yes, the variables that define the character of a butter. And they're essentially three very dynamic things, being the person, the plant, and the animal. The plant aspect in particular, it has a huge effect on the butter. You know, today animals can be fed grain or grass, and there's quite a variation in the butters that you get from that, not only the flavor, but nutritionally as well. A grass-fed butter definitely has more micronutrients in it than a butter that's from cows that are fed grain.
And that changes seasonally.
Yeah, and certainly in places where there's winter.
Right.
But even then, they're having a lot of silage and haylage. They're having fermented grass in addition to a little bit of grain. So we do have a really good system in place for keeping cows on grass year-round. So, I tell people butter is such a staple. And, you know, if you're going to have a little bit every day on your toast or your potato, whatever, I think it's really worth seeking out a good grass-fed butter.
Well, Elaine, it's been so great talking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Elaine Kasarova's book is Butter, A Rich History. Melissa Clark's latest is Dinner, Changing the Game. Now head to splendidtable.org for Elaine's recipe for butter-laced German pancakes.
reached has been disconnected.
It is time to turn to your calls now. You can join the conversation by phone, 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook or Twitter. Lucy's on the phone from St. Paul. Lucy, what would you like to talk about?
Five siblings and I went to Sicily in October, and we came back with all sorts of wonderful meal ideas. And I would like to make pasta alla norma for my family. And all the noodles that I often see with it are more tubular, mostaccioli, those kinds of things. And I'm wondering, I would like to do a homemade gnocchi. And I just haven't seen that out there. And I'm wondering what your opinion is to blend the two.
The word opinion really applies here. Gnocchi are from the north.
Okay.
And when you make gnocchi, for instance, in Rome, which would be the central or starting to be southern, you'll see that they're made very differently. They're made with a semolina flour, which is a coarse-ground hard wheat flour, and egg, and it's cooked and cooked and cooked, and they're made into little patties. And gnocchi made from potato and flour, which I think is what you're talking about, you would never, ever serve with Norma. And also, usually gnocchi are served very simply, because when they're done well, they're so luscious. You know, you would do something like a little butter and cheese and maybe some sage leaves. You know that. You know what I'm saying? It's or very light tomato sauce. I'd say stick with what you had in Sicily. That's what works, because pasta alla norma is an eggplant pasta, and it's a robust pasta. And you want a pasta with it that is robust. For instance, you'd never do angel hair. Angel hair is ethereal, and Norma is sensual, and it's robust, and it's, well, anyway. So, tubular pasta.
Rigatoni and mostaccioli.
Yeah, exactly. These larger tubular pastas are really wonderful. And I know they're klutzy to eat and all of that, but Italians have been dealing with it for hundreds of years. And no doubt you guys dealt with it brilliantly when you were in Sicily.
We did, that and others, yeah.
Yeah,
exactly.
Go with tradition. It's such a grand dish.
Okay.
Yeah. But why don't you make some gnocchi also? There is nothing wrong with having a little platter of gnocchi as a first course and then having the Norma.
That get our carbs for the day. That would be good.
Probably your carbs for the month.
How about a little side dish of hot Italian sausage with peppers and onions?
I don't think that would hurt anybody.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you, Lynn.
You take care. Bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Coming up, more of your calls and a look at a Chinese family business for the Chinese New Year. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. We are talking to you. Get to us with that phone, 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see. Who is up? Dave is calling from Clarence, New York. Hey, Dave, what's on your mind? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, Lynn, the backstory is my fiance is a CPA heading into tax season. Monster hours, 75 hours a week.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So I wanted to ask you about a simple dinner thing, like doing a stir fry.
Right.
That I can whip together when I have an idea when she's going to get home.
Mm-hmm.
And that it has some, you know, some savory kind of sparkle with some punch, and I just can't ever seem to get it right.
What goes wrong?
Well, it ends up sort of mushy and bland.
Uh-huh.
And all, like, it doesn't have any color. It all ends up being like this dull gravy color.
What are you cooking it in?
Just start with white rice, throwing in lots of soy sauce, occasionally a little bit of Japanese steak marinade, and then I just try to fry up some, you know, chopped up vegetables, and then I throw the cooked rice in on top of the cooked vegetable.
Okay. Stir fries generally all go through the same steps. First of all, a big pan or a wok, but big, so you can toss stuff. Usually what happens is the vegetables go in first, They get stir-fried to just about where you want them. You pull them out, heat up more oil, get it really hot, and then whatever the protein might be goes in, like chopped up meat or whatever. And you may have marinated that. You know, you may have marinated it with the steak sauce, for instance, and maybe a little chili, if you like sparkle and punch from that kind of thing.
Right,
and
right.
But you'll always make sure that the vegetables and any other things that go in are bone dry. And I think what's happening here, either your heat is not high enough or your vegetables are wet or damp. And they'll mm-hmm. never crisp up, the poor babies.
Okay.
Okay?
And what kind of oil for high heat?
For high heat, I like organic canola or grapeseed oil.
Okay.
Yeah. So what you do is get the pan very hot, high, high heat. Then just, you know, film in a little bit of oil. Have your vegetables that long before you put the pan on the stove, you've already cut them and dried them. One of the things I do is, to flavor it, I have some minced garlic and fresh ginger handy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I throw in the garlic and the fresh ginger when the oil is hot, okay? Oil goes into super hot pan. Give it a few moments. Stir that in just for a second and then dump in the veggies. And keep them moving. Stir fry them. Salt and pepper on them. You may need to do that for 2 or 3 minutes. And then what you do is immediately dump them into a shallow platter. So they don't steam. Wipe out the pan. Oil goes in. And this, you'll get so used to this, it takes moments. Throw in whatever kind of meat or whatever you're going to use. Don't season it until you've stir-fried it.
Yeah.
Don't add anything that's liquid. And then stir-fry that until it's where you want it. So if it's a piece, it's a little bit of beef, you might want it a little bit rare. So you stir fry it until it's crusty on the outside. You pull out a piece, you look at it. If it's something like, you know, fish, it's going to cook in no time. The vegetables go in, your seasoning goes in, you toss for a minute or two. And if you're adding rice, throw in the rice then, just to get it warm, and you're done.
Okay. And then maybe just a couple of tablespoons of soy sauce to finish it off?
Yeah. Yeah, soy sauce, you could throw in some hoisin sauce, you could use that steak sauce, you could use teriyaki sauce. You see what I'm saying? You could have a lot of fun with it.
Great. I'm really excited to try this. I'll let you know what happens.
Yeah, please do. Just remember, hot pan before oil and dry ingredients. Okay? All right.
Yeah.
Hey, thanks, Dave. It's a great question.
Okay, thank you, Lynn.
Take care.
Bye.
800-537-5252. Mike has called that number from Raleigh, North Carolina. Mike, what would you like to talk about?
I have a question about sous vide cooking.
Uh-huh.
And specifically, do you have any suggestions for cookbooks for individuals that are new to the idea and want to find out more about it? I bought Under Pressure by Thomas Keller, and it's a beautiful book. It's got a really good section on food safety, but I have a really hard time understanding the technique and the basic do's and don'ts in order for the recipes to come out properly.
Well, this is, I can tell you, first of all, a book came out this year, and it's called Sous Vide. It's done by a couple who have created a reasonably priced home sous vide system. And for anyone who isn't sure what sous vide means, it is essentially food goes into an airtight pouch and it's seasoned, etc. And the idea is it cooks in a container of water that is constantly moving to keep even temperature. And it is set at a particular temperature. So if you want your steak to have an internal temperature of 130 degrees, which would be medium rare, that's the temperature of the water. And it will bring it up and hold at 130 degrees. Now, the debate is harmful bacteria tends to grow between 40 and 140 degrees. And this is where there's debate about the safety. But the reality is that you can't leave the food in that environment indefinitely. But it does mean that you can do things ahead refrigerate them after they've been cooked, in quotes, and then, for instance, with a steak or a chop or anything that you want to brown, you just put it in a pan and you sear it.
Sear it.
Yeah. And so this new book, Sous Vide, and again, I can't remember the name of the people who have done it. They're selling a product, but their information is pretty solid. They're trying to simplify the process because it gets complicated, and I think it's become the darling of so many chefs using rather expensive setups. And their setup evidently is much more reasonable. I've been promising myself I'm going to try it at home. I've seen it done in restaurants. In fact, believe it or not, the first time I ever saw it in use was in 1985 in Paris. And Joël Robuchon, a very famous chef, was starting to experiment with it.
I've used it some.
You have a setup at home?
Yes, and I've cooked for some large groups, you know, for 40 or 50 people. And I've done like whole sirloins and beef ribs and turkey wings and some steaks for me personally. But the vegetables and the other things have always turned out really poorly.
Do you think it's because they can't be in that environment for the length of time that they're usually there?
I think the problem is if you look on the internet, the temperature ranges are all over the place. And I think the second problem is that a lot of the, like in the book by Thomas Keller, yeah, he's using a vacuum system that has an adjustment on it, and mine does not.
What kind of adjustment?
You can put it under more and more pressure, and then that changes the atmosphere within the bag.
Of course,
And that adjusts the amount of fibrousness in the item and things like that.
Yeah.
So I think that's been my biggest downfall in trying to follow his recipe.
Yeah, I think it's a case of the technology. It's just, you know, it's very hard to duplicate it at home. So essentially, I think you want to get a hold of this sous vide book.
Okay.
Because they're talking exclusively to the home cook. Now, by the way, there may be some other books out as well, but this one looked like it was fairly well done.
Great.
Okay?
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear you're experimenting with it. I've got to get my own setup.
It really, especially high-end meats and low-end meats, come out really spectacular.
I can imagine. How do flavorings hold up in it?
When a meat comes out of sous vide, it looks very unappetizing.
Right, right.
So you've got to sear it or brown it or broil it or do something. But whatever the flavor you put in, whether it's a citrus or an herb or whatever,
right,
it penetrates all the way through to the bone.
That is really worthwhile. Well, Mike, thank you. This is golden.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, you take care.
Have a good one.
You too. Well, this is a case where I don't know if I answered Mike's question, but Mike answered my questions. And it's all illuminating. Remember, you can always get to us at 800-537-5252. The next time you grab a bite at a food court, look around. 10 to 1, you'll see a Panda Express. With 2,000 restaurants, Panda Express is the largest family-owned American Chinese chain in the United States. Notice I said American Chinese, not Chinese American. 40 years ago, when Andrew and Peggy Chern opened the Panda Inn, all they wanted to do was assimilate, keep their heads down, work hard, and be as American as possible. Their daughter, Andrea Chern, is now at the helm as the chief marketing officer. Like her parents, she's dedicated to growing the business, and she's also dedicated to honoring them by reclaiming their heritage. Contributor Melanie Dunay talked to Andrea about the ethos behind that family business.
Andrea, it's great to have you here.
Thank you, Melanie. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, Andrea, how did your family business actually start?
Sure. So, over 40 years ago, our family started the Pasadena Panda Inn. It's a sit-down, family-style restaurant in Pasadena, California. And my father was front of the house. He was the person that greeted you and welcomed you. And my grandfather was back of the house. He was the chef. And he is the chef that has inspired actually many of our recipes to this day. And he was trained in Yangzhou in culinary and then traveled to Japan and was the head chef at a hotel and then immigrated to the U.S. and started his own restaurant with my father.
So when the current variation of Panda Express opened, was it meant to be an American Chinese restaurant or a Chinese restaurant?
My family's story of opening American Chinese restaurants is very similar to many immigrant stories to the U.S. They came here and they needed to build a life for themselves. My mother, for example, came and studied mathematics and electrical engineering and so has a PhD in electrical engineering and ended up joining the family business as a way of supporting the family. So you hear a lot of immigrant stories of individuals coming from China to the U.S. And because they were blocked out of certain professional spheres, ending up opening up restaurants. They took what they knew and they tailored it to an American audience in order to have the volume of business they needed to really provide. We started with one restaurant over 40 years ago and now are approaching 1,900 restaurants.
Wow.
We started... Yes.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It's an incredible achievement.
It is.
But really, the credit goes to, we started as one family to now we have over 30,000 families that we help support and that actually are the driving force behind our success. That's really the incredible feat.
So what does Panda Express represent now?
I think Panda represents how many in the U.S., embody dual identities. It's not sort of more American or more Chinese. It's much like I am. I am both American and I am both Chinese. And I am influenced by both in the same ways that our food is influenced by both. But I'll say that for our American Chinese, what becomes really important is to understand our role as an ambassador of Chinese food to the U.S. and as an ambassador of Chinese culture. So we always start with what is the authentic Chinese inspiration? For our chefs, I often ask, what are the food memories that you had growing up in your households, like the comfort food that your mom made for you, that it's authentically Chinese, and how do we bring that to a wider audience?
Well, speaking of which, the orange chicken, I heard that basically it is so crazy popular that 1 out of 5 people actually order it.
1 out of 3, actually.
Whoa.
So it actually is around 30% of our mix is orange chicken. And we just opened our first restaurant again in Japan. And over 90% of the transactions involved orange chicken.
That is amazing. Now, there must be some pressure for you being in this family business. I mean, they didn't just hand you this job.
No, they did not just hand me this job. I think that more than anything else, we as a family think a lot about stewardship. One of the rules or one of the maxims of our family is that the family serves the business and the business doesn't serve the family. And I remember sort of there is a scene right after college where my father came to visit me and I was set on a very different trajectory and determined to set my own path. And I remember him stopping me one night before we were going to bed and him asking me, Andrea, how are you going to take care of our people? And me in my sort of young adulthood independence was thinking in my mind, these are your people. They are not my people. I'd never agreed that to take on your people. But that ethos has been so ingrained in us that we often think about how we are going to be taking care of the people that really are the success of our business. And so I think that the pressure comes from how do we ensure that the jobs that we provide are really speaking to our mission of inspiring better lives. And I have to say that sometimes I take myself too seriously and I put too much pressure on myself. But I think that in all of this, what we do is, as Peggy will say, we just look for what is best for our people and what is best for our company. And we do everything in our power to be able to deliver on what's best.
Andrea, with Chinese New Year upon us, I want to say Happy New Year and thank you so much.
You're welcome. 新年快乐, Melanie. It was a pleasure to spend time with you.
Andrea Chern is Chief Marketing Officer of Panda Express. Melanie Dunay is a celebrity photographer and creator of My Last Supper. Well, that's the show for this week. It's great to have you with us. We'll talk again next week. In the meantime, let me leave you with this thought from Marcus Samuelson, who said, like all food, whether you're talking about Persian food or Chinese food or Swedish food, it's always a reflection of wars, trading, a bunch of good and a bunch of bad. But what's left is always the food story. If you like what you heard here today, subscribe to our podcast. Follow us on Instagram and Pinterest. And as always, you can find information on everything you heard here today at splendidtable.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Courtney McEwen. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Chip Walton is our digital associate producer. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.